All right. Hey, we're going to continue our series on Jesus teaching theology. And can you hear this fine? Is this good? Okay. And we were going to do one topic for every theological topic we had kind of chosen or Wendell had put out there, which is around, there's about 8 of them to 9 of them. And then I came to today's. Today's is on Jesus, what Jesus taught about the Christ or taught about himself. And as I was preparing and going through it, it just seems inadequate to spend one Sunday to do that. And so I would like to look at least 3 different Sundays on 3 different passages about what Jesus teaches about himself. And I think that would be beneficial to us, especially in this Easter season. You know, before we get bogged down on everything else that could possibly be going on in our lives, that we just come here every Sunday and just focus on Jesus and what Jesus said about himself. I don't think there's a better way to spend your time, honestly. If our belief and our hope is in him, I think what he shared, if we just spent time just going through it, it would be edifying. It would be faith foundational, certainty, whatever you want to call that. It would give you the roots that would help us build all of the rest of our theology on it as well. And so we're going to start in John chapter 8, actually. And we're going to continue doing this way. You know, over the past 2 Sundays, we've gone through what God taught about salvation, or what Jesus taught about salvation. Then last week, what Jesus taught about sin. And you come to the conclusion of that, realizing that there has to be some sort of hope. There has to be something to help you out. And obviously, salvation, belief in Jesus Christ will provide you a hope in the midst of your sin, right? But the question is who is this Jesus person? And what better day to start than the day that Jesus rose from the dead, the day we celebrate on Easter? And so we're going to do this by going through his passage. Then I'll give you a little bit of time to read it yourself so you can reflect. We're going to make some observations with slight interpretations. I think making observations without small interpretations is too difficult in a class. And personally, I don't like it because I think observations can be boring if you don't start interpreting them. But we'll stop. We'll debate them. We'll talk about them, those sort of things. And then we're going to look at some other passages in Scripture to solidify what he said, maybe the context, those sort of things. And then we're going to come back around to it. We're going to say this is what Jesus was clearly saying about himself. And so this is Jesus teaching about himself, or teaching about the Christ. Obviously, one of the things you have to understand about Jesus is that Jesus is God in the flesh, specifically the Son of God in flesh, right? We believe in, there's a couple of assumptions we're going to make going into this lesson, that Jesus is part of the triune God. He is fully God. He's also fully man. He was born man and is 100% man, but he also never conceded or gave up any of his deity in that essence. He is 100% God as well. In fact, early in his ministry, and as he was walking, actually very early in his ministry, right after his baptism, he was actually tempted by Satan himself in the wilderness. In a time where man would be deprived of all things because he's in the wilderness, he is fasting for a period of time, Satan tempted him with the very things that Satan himself, I believe, fell from his position when he was Lucifer in the heavenlies. The very same temptations he fell from and fell with are the very things he tried to tempt Jesus with. Jesus did not. So not only is he the perfect man and a sinless man, he's also perfect in the realm of all things and more than that. And it's one of those distinctives that you can walk into. So walking into this passage, we know his background is he is God. He is 100% man. He is sinless. And he is the anointed Christ. And so we assume those. So who is this person? And so that's what leads us to our passage today. The claims of Jesus are an important part of Christology and the study of doctrine concerning Jesus Christ. Probably the most important sayings actually about Jesus are possibly in this John 8, 31 through 59. So let's take a look at this passage, and we're going to read it together, go back through it and skim it or read it yourself, and then we will start making observations with a little bit of interpretation. Verse 31 of John chapter 8. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will see and know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves to anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" Jesus replied, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me, because you have no room for my word. I am telling you what I have seen in the Father's presence, and you are doing what you have heard from your father." They answered, "Abraham is our father." Jesus replied, "If you were Abraham's children, then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you are looking for a way to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. Abraham did not do such things. You are doing the works of your own father." They protested, "We are not illegitimate children. The only father we have is God himself." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I have come here from God. I have not come on my own. God sent me. Why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say? You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native tongue, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Yet, because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I am telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Whoever belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you do not belong to God." The Jews answer him, "Aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and a demon possessed?" "I am not possessed by a demon," said Jesus, "but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Very truly, I tell you, whoever obeys my word will never see death." At this, they exclaimed, "Now we know you're demon possessed. Abraham died, and so did the prophets. Yet you say that whoever obeys your word will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham? He died, and so did the prophets. Who do you think you are?" Jesus replied, "If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and obey his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You're not yet 50 years old," they said to him, "and you've seen Abraham?" "Very truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. All right, quite a long section. Feel free to read through it again, quietly. I'm going to give you 3 minutes to read through it. So skim the parts you want to skim. I read it slowly so that you could follow along and maybe come up with some questions or observations as we went through. But this time, I will be quiet. Your turn to read. Let's do one more minute. All right. Remember, in this section, I'm going to ask you to share with me where you got this claim, okay? So think about this. Who did Jesus claim to be in this section? What did he say about himself? Who would like to go first? I'm sorry?
Okay, 31, he's a teacher.
All right, who else?
He was
said he was God. What verse?
58.
Okay, I am.
I've always existed.
Oh, he's always existed. How do you know that?
Before Abraham was born, I am.
Okay, so same verse. There's actually other passages in there that also reveal that. Yes? Catherine?
To himself identified directly as his son in verse 36.
All right.
Interesting. In verse 50, I don't know if it's the proper term, but he's the one bringing the truth, not the judge. And plus the judge comes in. So I guess there's two of them in 50. Bring the truth,
else,
not the judge. Truth
bringer. Yeah, bringer of truth. He indirectly says not judge, although he probably is the judge based off of other passages.
Right. But later, right?
But later, yeah. So now's not the time.
Right.
We'll put that in parentheses. Because he doesn't want them to focus on that either.
Right.
What else? Okay.
He's
or God. Yeah, he's glorified by the Father, referring to God himself, or, as you use the word, testifies about him. Okay.
Jesus is one who knows God.
Yes. Knows. What verse was that?
That is verse
55. 55.
Repeatedly he says to the Jews that they are not following the God of Abraham.
Okay.
In terms of verses like
help me say something about Jesus by doing that. That he's...
He is following.
He is.
He is the God of Abraham.
Okay. I can do that. Abraham is very significant in this passage. In fact, I'm just going to write Abraham here, and we'll build on that. Abraham is mentioned 11 times in the section we just mentioned.
Verse 2 and 40, he talks about being a tree.
Okay.
Can I know about his age in verse 57? They said he's under 50.
Yes. He's not yet 50. Yeah. What verse was that again?
57.
Verse 46, he calls himself blameless.
Calls himself what?
Blameless.
Blameless,
sinless.
Yeah. What verse was that again? Tom, what you got? Okay. All right, let me read these out. He's a teacher. He claims to be God. He's always existed, which should go hand in hand with God. He is the Son, so he has an identity within the Godhead. He's a truth bringer at this time. He's there to bring truth. He's glorified by the Father, God, and God the Father testifies about him. Jesus claims to know God in a very personal level. There's identification with Abraham, which I want to get to in a little bit, that even Abraham treated him different than those people that claimed to be descendants of Abraham were treating him, which meant that they were not actually descendants of Abraham. You'll see that connection here in a bit. A whole lot of emphasis on the fact that he's got the truth in comparison to what's going on, because in comparison, he's actually saying, no, you're following a liar. You're following Satan himself and what he would do, and I am actually the opposite. And if you treated me with love like the Father did, then you would what, you would be also a son of God, I guess. And then under 50 years old, so we know this is young. He's a young man at this time, or at least I consider him a young man. There was a time where I didn't consider him a young man until I got to the age I am now, when now I realize that is incredibly young. And he is blameless. He claims to be blameless and sinless. There's other observations as well. Cindy? Yes. Keeps word equal no death. What else?
Straight out says that he's not possessed by a demon.
He does say that. What verse was that again? I'm sorry.
It's 49.
What are some things you can infer based off of his personality or his character during this time? Now we've seen what he says. He definitely says those things. But based off of his mannerisms, his personality, his character, what can you possibly add to it?
He's not easily intimidated.
He speaks with authority.
What else? I have not intimidated, or not easily intimidated, authority. He speaks with authority, but he's also very patient with these people.
Very logical in the way he argues.
Rational, I heard that too. What else?
He's not afraid to confront, and he's willing to lose favor and
virtue. Okay. Yeah, I have truthful over here. I'm trying to think like conviction. It's a good one. Conviction. What I was trying to do is like, yes, but in a way, isn't that incredibly gracious? Like that's where I go. The fact that he would, what comes across as being possibly, man, I know this is going to step on your toes. You're going to be offended by this. But if I don't say it, who's going to say it to you? And who can say it to you? So there's a lot of grace there too. Let me do Catherine, and I'll come back to you, Tom. But she'll probably get yours since that's what's happened twice.
He has information and just wisdom about God that the people he's talking to don't.
Absolutely. All right, Tom. Was that it?
Can you quickly? I don't want to rabbit trail anything, but can you just quickly clarify in verse 30? Says, even as he spoke, many believed in him. And then in 31, to the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said all these things below. So these are people, according to verse 30, who have believed what he said, and then he kind of comes at them, quote, guns blazing.
Right. That, it's a highly debated section. People have written believed in, believed on. I don't understand the difference between in and on. I'll tell you where I landed, and I'm not super comfortable with this. So this is not one of those hills I'm willing to die on, and I'm willing to go, yeah, absolutely. My conviction or my reading of it is that they believed in him enough that they continued to listen to what he said instead of being like those people that would walk away. And so there was you see that over and over in Jesus, and I get that from other passages and other stories about Jesus. As Jesus challenged people in the truth, it was too hard for them to hear. They left, but some stuck around. And you would even have descriptions like that. I believe these people are people that still stuck around. They were willing to go through it. However, in the midst of those people, there were enemies and Pharisees that were trying to kill Jesus. In fact, he says that. And so it's not as if it's an all-inclusive of the entire audience, but he was speaking to those people that were willing to continue on through him, even with the harsh truths. Because we're in the book of John here. Prior to this, John records, he says, hey, I'm the bread of life. In fact, you've got to eat of my body. And if you don't do that, you aren't going to live forever. And many of them said, what? No way. Well, these people stuck around because this is John 8. And so it's those types of... And that's where I think that belief description comes in there. But like I said,
I'm thinking charismatic. To be able to hold the attention of groups of people, you have to be charismatic even if those people don't agree with you or think you're lying, but you still hold their attention long enough.
Absolutely. I think we can spend an unbelievable amount of time in this passage. In fact, when I think back to my seminary days when it was time to write exegeticals and those sort of things, I actually regret not choosing this passage. I don't even know if it was an option, actually. But still, this is one of those that there's so much laying in there that's unbelievable. The way Abraham is used, we touched on this just a little bit. The way Abraham is used in this discussion by both sides is incredibly important. If you know anything about the Jewish people, they claimed Abraham as their father was unbelievably significant towards their faith and towards their stance whenever they come to holding the truth. If they didn't believe in Abraham, then therefore they can't believe the truth that God has given them. He was the rock. He was the almost the cornerstone to some extent for which their faith was built on. Why? Because Abraham was the first one to receive the promise that created a people that was supposed to be a priest to the nation so the rest of the world would know. Abraham is unbelievably significant in the Jewish community. In fact, think about this. Abraham comes in Genesis chapter 12, where he accepts the promise. Do you know what happens in Genesis chapter 9, 10, and 11? 9, 10, and 11 is Noah's Ark, where God wipes the earth clean of all the disobedient, right? Noah comes out of the ark. You probably know this story. So does two of every animal. And for those people that believe this, so do the baby dinosaurs that can't live, and that's the reason there's dinosaurs around. I've heard people say that. My dad is a strong believer in that. I have no idea what to do with it. And so it's just one of those that I'm not at. I don't have to know every answer, but what I do know is Noah came off that ark. And when Noah came off that ark, from his generation came many of the nations around the world. But God gave him one rule. Do you know what that rule was? Spread out and... maybe that's two rules. All right, spread out and multiply over the entire earth. Why? Because the earth had just been washed. It's just been cleansed. And now he wants to be fruitful and multiply. The people of the earth did something else. What did they choose to do? Build a tower, right? What did God do to stop them in a gracious way so that they would follow the rule to spread out and multiply? What did he do? Changed their languages, and people got with the people that they understood, and they spread out and they multiplied. Funny how God got what he wanted after all, right? All those nations were created out of disobedience. Chapter 12. He takes one man from the land of Ur, and he says, if you will faithfully follow me, I will build a nation out of you. So all the other nations on earth were built out of disobedience. However, there's one nation that was built out of obedience. And that was the nation that started with Abraham. Abraham is incredibly foundational to their truth. And every other word they received from God after they became a nation was one for which they were supposed to be a light to the world. So to say they are people and of Abraham is a significant thing. Yes, Deidre.
So in verse 33, where they say we are Abraham's descendants, what's their rationale for saying we have never been slaves of anyone? Because
they don't even know the truth. That's the irony of that, because he's pointing them to the truth.
Oh, that's a great comment. I don't know. I feel like, yeah, the Jewish people have clearly been enslaved.
Selective memory.
They have selective memory. At this moment, those people probably don't feel like they are enslaved. But Jesus isn't even talking about a physical enslavement here. He immediately and clearly which is one of the things I think that we could have done, which I see a logical and rational. I think those are unbelievable observations because Jesus walks slowly with this through them. If you have any sin at all, you are enslaved to sin, which they would agree with, by the way, very much taught at that time. He is using their own teachings that are shared in the Talmud and others in a way that they would connect with and say, oh, I guess you're right. We won't push back on that one, actually. Isn't that interesting? So there's the wisdom aspect of it as well. Abraham goes from an advocate or a witness to them to actually being the accuser in this story. Did you notice that? Once they thought they had Abraham on their side. And then Jesus said, well, actually, Abraham was excited to see my coming. And he acted different to me than you are now because many of you are trying to kill me. This threw them off a little bit. So then, naturally, again, struggling with the same thing, not the spiritual, but the physical, just like they did with the slave comment, they said, aren't you younger than 50? You aren't even 50 years old, and you're telling us you know Abraham? Passing over the whole argument earlier where he says, by the way, I knew God, I was with God, who is clearly older than Abraham, they would all agree. Then Jesus drops the bombshell of all bombshells, the name above all names. And he says, before Abraham was, I am. If you are unaware of what that name and significance means, then I highly encourage you to go and research a little bit Exodus 3. When God reveals himself to Moses in the burning bush. And Moses' huge claim, get this, to lead people out of slavery is that he needs a name by which he can use that people will allow his people to escape. He was just talking about those people that are caught up in sin are enslaved. Jesus connects the name to freeing from slavery again. And the very same one that did it physically in the Old Testament is doing it spiritually now. And that name is I Am. The name I Am, in its own meaning, in its own name, is self-existent. In fact, it's such an oddity of a name that no one else would ever claim to be named I Am either. It's very unique. It means to be, or it comes from that root word that we believe it is, that is just being. Existence is what it claims. It claims all the Old Testament God authority and position. And he places it squarely on his shoulders as a 33-year-old man walking on earth. This would cause some people to get upset because there are laws against doing this. Yes?
Yeah, like every time in the Old Testament you see capital L-O-R-D in our Bibles, that's what Jesus is claiming to be.
Absolutely.
That's yes. The name he's using.
It's that Yahweh. It's where we get Jehovah from. Because Jewish people thought the name was such a great name that they used the wrong vowels in Yahweh whenever they wrote it out. So that if you actually sounded it out phonetically, it would be Jehovah instead of Yahweh. That's where the name Jehovah comes from. Out of respect and reverence for the name Yahweh, which means I am. Nothing would upset these people more than claiming to be that God that sets people free. That was self-existence. And in that story, by the way, proved that he was the God of those that had died that are still living in Genesis 3. Because to prove it, he says, I am the God of who? Isaac and Jacob, right? And so, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, obviously. So that name has always made that connection. And I find it unbelievably ironic that Jesus, not ironic, I would find it unbelievably brilliant that Jesus would choose to use that name in this conversation right here, showing his wisdom. Jesus claims all these things about himself. And let me tell you, we've missed about 85% of everything that he has revealed in this little section. And you can go back through it over and over and over and over again, which should give you even more reason to dig in more to it, right? But because this is pretty much our time that we can spend on these observations and the background and what's going on, we must push forward. What do you see in the people that respond to Jesus? What do you see happening to them in their attitude? Anger. Offensiveness. Defensiveness, okay. When you encounter Jesus based off of that, what do you think encountering Jesus causes you to do? Yes, in the back.
Andy had a really quote in a sermon last week. He said, at one point, the enemies of Christ the issue no longer the truth. I said, the enemies of Christ, the issue is no longer the truth. They know the truth. The issue becomes the eradication of the proof that they are wrong. I thought that was really kind of, for me, like...
I know you did. That's the third time I've heard you quote it. You quoted it Thursday night, and you quoted it last Sunday.
You talk about Jesus being rational. You see, standing in front of an audience, to me, the greatest proof of who he is just says, which one of you convicts me of sin? I mean, he's standing in front of his greatest enemies, saying, okay, discredit me. I've said all these outrageous things. Which one of you convicts me of sin? I'm like,
right.
The greatest enemies have, this is your opportunity, and they can't even do that. So it's like, they, from that, you have to see, they know they're wrong. I mean, they know, I mean, that was their opportunity. We can't discredit him of sin. So what's your other option? That's what your option is, to get rid of him. We can't.
Right.
There's no way else to fight against him.
In the face of God, the weird thing that does is you don't become more rational, you become more irate and irrational in your response if you don't respond gracious and mercy. I mean, do you remember the story later on in John where actually he raises Lazarus from the dead? And they are so hard-hearted by this point, they think, maybe not, you know what? He did raise someone from the dead. That's kind of different. That's we might need to listen to this guy. There's some Old Testament occurrences where someone did something similar to this, and they were prophets from God, so maybe we should listen to him. Instead, they said, you know what we need to do? We should kill Lazarus, or else people will start following him too, which is completely illogical. And also, by the way, against the commandments by which you are judged over, and that is one of the main 10. It's right off the bat. It's highlighted. It's a bold one. In fact, it's short. It doesn't even have a description. Thou shalt not murder. Move on to the next one. We don't need to talk about it. It's an important one, and everybody gets it. It's like lying, by the way, is also in there. Don't lie. So, my point and my poor question didn't solicit the response. So let me say it this way. When Jesus reveals who he is and you start digging into it, you have to respond one of two ways, right? C.S. Lewis has the famous quote where he said, the 3L quote, right? He's either a liar, a lunatic, or a Lord. And by the way, some brilliant philosophy guy came in later and said, well, actually, he could be a legend, too. It means he grows in, because he wanted to argue with C.S. And so he comes in and he says, you could be a legend, where actually what was told back then was lied to you, and therefore you believe the legend of what it was, and it grows and grows. More time has been gone away. Well, the great thing about that is we have textual criticism, and we have a better document for this time period than anybody's even comes close to having. So to not believe the eyewitnesses and those people that heard the first stories that wrote it down. And by the way, I believe moved by the Spirit, so God himself wrote it. To not believe those is actually a weirder opinion than choosing to believe the opinions that were there. And so even from a logical standpoint, that doesn't make sense either. So what's my point? My point is that Jesus himself forces you to respond. He doesn't allow you to sit on the fence about who he is. That's why I think writing out and consolidating who Jesus is a very important task for all of us. And we're going to do this a couple of times through his many passages. So based off of this, let me give you the observations you gave me. He's clearly a teacher. He claims to be God. He's the Son of God, specifically. Always existing. He is the one that brings and shares the truth. And by the way, his truth he shares, the word he shares, prevents people from death if they believe it and they follow it. He's glorified by the Father who testifies about him. Jesus knows God intimately. It's not secondhand. Abraham testifies about him as well. He's truth. He's under 50 years old. Might not include that there, but that's all right. He is blameless, sinless, and he is not possessed. He is the one who provides possessions for us, right? Through the Holy Spirit, will fill us. And in his demeanor, when he shared with us, when he shared with people, he was not intimidated by us. Think about that. Of course he's not intimidated by us. He created us. He created us. And just think about this. Was he intimidated by Satan? No. How much longer has Satan lived than these people that were walking with Jesus? You think Satan might have learned something over years and years and years and years and years that would have made him more intimidating? There is no question man could bring before him, even as the God-man, which gives him ultimate authority. And that's why he's so patient. We look at his patience and we think, man, he is incredibly patient. And he is incredibly patient. But the truth is, if you think about his existence, think how impatient he is now. He's logical, rational, obviously, because he's the one that created logic and rationality. And so he's convicted because it's true. And his wisdom and his charismatic expressions help us to connect to him in a way that we should never be able to connect to a God. And he did this by becoming man, which we didn't even put on here, by the way. He's clearly man. And the only place we actually included that is right here. Around 30 years old, under 50. I don't know how to write a statement. I think it would take us too long to write one. But we could say this. Jesus, who is God himself, the Son, always existing, taught us the truth. And those that believe in his words and keep his words shall not have death. And Abraham, God, both testify to him and his coming. Yeah, I would do something like that, possibly. Next week, we're going to look at another passage of Jesus. And interesting, it's going to actually show even more depth to who he is. But just in this one statement, you can learn a lot. There is no other person by which you can have salvation, and there is no other hope. Just in this section.